On behalf of the Clark Forum and Dickinson College, I would like to welcome you to this afternoon's event, When Bob Dylan Came Knocking. Regarding American culture, Dylan once wrote that he just thought of mainstream culture as lame as hell and one big trick. But despite his view of mainstream culture, Dylan has become an icon of American popular culture. Eric Lott is a professor of English at the University of Virginia. He is the author of several books, including Love and Theft, Blackface, Minstrelsy, and the American Working Class, The Disappearing Liberal Intellectual, and the forthcoming Tangled Up Blue, The Cultural Contradictions of American Racism. Although Dylan and Professor Lott may appear to be completely unconnected, they are in fact linked in an unexpected way. In 2001, Dylan took the title of Lott's book, Love and Theft, and put it on his album. Dylan's theft of Love and Theft symbolizes an important theme of Lott's view of American culture. That is, that appropriations are fundamental to it. At this time, I would like to ask you to turn off all electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this program is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has reached you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Eric Lott.
Am I on?
That was a perfect introduction. Thank you so much. Because it does really set up,
I need my water, what I'd like to talk about this afternoon, which is the not only the prevalence, but the fundamental kind of centrality of cultural appropriation to the production of all culture, American culture generally. It works by appropriation, by recombination, reinvention. And I want to talk about these themes insofar as they touch on race relations, popular culture in particular, and its relation to what Flaubert called a sentimental education, the education of the sensibilities in college and out, and popular culture's importance to identity formation as a culture and each of us as people, the way in which it affords us a sense of self and identity. Thank you very much for having me. I'm very delighted to be here on this beautiful day, and thank you for coming inside on such a beautiful day to hear me speak. What I'm going to talk about is something I haven't spoken about before, which is why Bob Dylan might have stolen my title. Because I was flattered and gratified, and it kind of put the title, which I was fond of, that's why I titled my book Love and Theft, into a more widespread circulation. Of course, for a while, when I first heard that Dylan was going to call his record Love and Theft, Greil Marcus, a rock critic, called me on the phone and said, I just heard this news. I was afraid that the record was going to be terrible, and people for months then were going to be going around saying, Love and Theft really sucks. And no one would know when they were talking about my book or their record. Turns out that the record is very good and almost bottomless in its interest. And I want to talk about some of the meanings I make of it anyway. Okay, so I have an epigraph, I guess, or a little quotation. It's a lengthy quotation, but it's from Jonathan Latham essay in Harper's Magazine, which you may have read, called The Ecstasy of Influence. And the point of this piece is really to suggest that all culture, high and low, is generated out of other cultural forms, you know, out of recombination, appropriation, outright theft. And that's the way it works. And that's what's interesting about it. He tells the following story. In 1941, on his front porch, Muddy Waters recorded a song for the folklorist Alan Lomax. After singing the song, which he told Lomax was entitled Country Blues, Waters described how he came to write it. "I made it on the 8th of October, 38," Waters said. I was fixing a puncture on a car. I had been mistreated by a girl. I just felt blue, and the song fell into my mind, and it came to me just like that, and I started singing." Then Lomax, who knew of the Robert Johnson recording called Walkin' Blues, asked Waters if there were any other songs that had used the same tune. "There's been some blues played like that," Waters replied. "This song comes from the cotton field, and a boy once put a record out, Robert Johnson. He put it out as named Walkin' Blues. I heard the tune before I heard it on the record. I learned it from Son House." So here's Latham's nice conclusion. In nearly one breath, Waters offers five different accounts. His own act of authorship. He made it on a specific date. Then the passive explanation. It came to me just like that. After Lomax raises the question of influence, Waters, without shame, misgivings, or trepidation, says that he heard a version by Johnson, but that his mentor, Son House, this is the fourth, taught it to him. In the middle of that complex genealogy, Waters declares that this song comes from the cotton field. That's a nice little tale, and it's a nice little instance of the way in which we kind of tell ourselves different stories about these issues of appropriation. "When gravity fails, put on a mask. America is a land of masking jokers," Ralph Ellison said, "trying to find some kind of way out of here. Latitude is what you want, to beat the fixity of location and identity. Of course, this often involves trafficking in someone else's, the mixed erotic economy of racial celebration and exploitation that drove blackface minstrelsy and that has driven much of pop music since." And it's necessary today for me to talk about the relationship between Bob Dylan and blackface minstrelsy, since he took his title, Love and Theft, for his record, from a book about blackface minstrelsy. And therefore, it's important to know the basics of the minstrel show, which is that it was an enormously popular entertainment form in the 19th century into the 20th century, where it had an afterlife, long afterlife, on film in Hollywood, which basically involves white people putting on blackface makeup in order to imitate, inhabit the cultural performances, performative forms of African, what they imagined to be those forms of African-American culture. It was quite explicitly racist in the 19th century, but what I argue in my book is that at the same time there was a strange cross-racial fascination, and that cross-racial fascination kind of founds a whole pop cultural genealogy of cross-racial interest in the United States. Leslie Fiedler, in a book whose title I riffed on for my Love and Theft, Blackface Minstrels in the American Working Class, his book is called Love and Death in the American Novel, you may know, famously suggested, this is Fiedler, that U.S. narrative is continually possessed by the idea of two men, one white and one dark, alone together in the American void. Huck and Jim, it happens again and again in American narrative. Huck and Jim, Kirk and Dr. Spock, Dre and Eminem. The minstrel show's miscegenation in one body, the white man inhabiting the black, literalized this imaginary proximity, the fascination with and heisting of black cultural materials. When Bob Dylan turned to Jack Frost, when he produces his own records, he says that they're produced by Jack Frost, which is him. It's a pseudonym. When he turned to Jack Frost to produce his great 2001 album, Love and Theft, he generated another mask to handle the cultural mash he advanced, where, as he put it in an interview, the original influences are represented, but not anymore in their original form, like barley into whiskey. If Dylan's mash is a little sour, as you'll hear, it's because it's so fully aged. Dylan could only have made this record at 60. He was 60 in 2001. Not just because it showcases a ripped and ragged voice, but also because of its incredible range, literary, musical, and philosophical. I'll argue here that in addition to its reflections on the musical relations of race and artistic borrowing generally, its theory of culture, Dylan's Love and Theft advances as well an intricately related musical theory of affective life in middle age. I may not get to all of that. We'll see how I do with the time I have. If once he used ideas as maps, in a famous song he sings, he's older than that now. feeling his way, pledging his time, lion in winter, mapping his country. In the words of Dylan's publicist, Mr. Dylan neither confirms nor denies a connection between the title of his album and the title of that book. Mine. Thanks a lot. And that was it. No word from with me or anyone else before or after on why he chose the title, the only one of his then 44 albums, album titles, to be placed in quotation marks. So on the record cover, which is there, I think you can see it, Loving Theft is actually in quotation marks. Greil Marcus, author of Invisible Republic, Bob Dylan's Basement Tapes, and the book Like a Rolling Stone, Bob Dylan at the Crossroads, put it to me this way. I don't know that Dylan's read your book, but wouldn't be surprised. He's a true scholar of old American music and all that goes with it. I suspect Dylan liked my title for its general resonance, in which stolen hearts and emotional misdemeanors stalk the sweetness of love, as they usually do in Dylan's songs. More particularly, though, he knows full well the cross-cultural indebtedness of music in the Americas, his included, and alludes to it in the songs as well as the title, itself stolen, of Love and Theft. Dylan is certainly no stranger to blackface, as he remarked in a 2001 interview, "Desolation Row, that's a minstrel song through and through. I saw some ragtag minstrel show in blackface at the carnivals when I was growing up, and it had an effect on me, just as much as seeing the lady with four legs." I wonder what the effect of the lady with four legs was, but that carnival atmosphere suffuses Dylan's 2003 film, Masked and Anonymous. I'll show you a clip from it in a moment, which at a key moment features a muse-like Ed Harris in full darky regalia, Ed Harris in blackface. High Water for Charlie Patton's song on Love and Theft, with its banjo, tambourine, and other clattering percussion, is the Love and Theft song that sounds the most like 19th century minstrel show music, which is interesting, not only since it's influenced by and dedicated to Delta blues man Patton. It's named after, you know, Charlie Patton's High Water Everywhere and High Water Everywhere Part 2, but also because it's a song of high seriousness, as though ultimate truths are rooted in cultural plunder. I'll play a little bit of it.
Being stolen away. Picked your turner, looking east and west from the dark room of his mind. He made your Kansas City 12th Street and Vine. Nothing standing there. I wanna hear it with him.
As he sings in another song on the record, Sugar Baby. Some of these bootleggers, they make pretty good stuff. Plenty of places to hide things here if you want to hide them bad enough. Moonshiners, sure, he's referring to bootleggers. But pirated recordings, too, perhaps Dylan's most enduring legacy. And pirated sources, as well, which floated many of those recordings. He's always been something of a blues man. On Love and Theft alone, the range and number of these borrowings is astonishing. They include, at the very least, name droppings, borrowings, appropriations, which he's almost flaunting all across the record. The range and number of these is astonishing. They include, at the very least, Lewis Carroll, Tennessee Williams, The Myth of Icarus, Robert Johnson, Johnny Cash, Elmore James, A Parchman Farm Prison Song, the work song Rosie, Elvis, The Great Gatsby, Blind Willie McTell, W.C. Fields, West Side Story, Stephen Foster, Romeo and Juliet, Charlie Patton, Joe Turner, Jane Eyre, Clarence Ashley, Doc Boggs, Night of the Hunter, Ode to a Nightingale, John Donne, P.T. Barnum's Chang and Eng, Othello, The Three Little Pigs, Knock Knock Jokes, Howlin' Wolf, Don Pasquale, The Bible, and Darktown Strutter's Ball, as if Dylan's daring us to accuse him of theft, which people subsequently did, again, when it was discovered that he'd lifted quite a bit of the song Floater on the record from a Japanese gangster memoir, Junichi Saga's Confessions of a Yakuza, or that the very melody of Sugar Baby was boosted from a 1928 Gene Austin pop number called Lonesome Road. Who's going to throw that minstrel boy a coin? This is not to say that Dylan's simply a blackface artist, like Michelle Schacht, a little too abjectly proclaimed herself to be on her 1992 album, Arkansas Traveler, the cover of which was originally to feature her in blackface makeup. And she didn't want to do it for racist reasons, but for anti-racist reasons, just to acknowledge how much white or dominant or mainstream popular American culture has been generated out of African-American materials, often unacknowledgedly so. No. Cultural miscegenation, a stupid word, not only because of its racist origins, but also because you probably can't show me an instance of culture that isn't somehow mixed in kind, is, on the contrary, a spur to newness and uniqueness in Dylan. If there's an original thought out there, I could use it right now, Dylan jokes in Brownsville Girl, a song of 1986. That opus spun out of Wild West movies, border ballads, gospel music, Dust Bowl sagas, Sam Shepard plays, he co-wrote it with Sam Shepard, Alamo fables, and parables and paradoxes and 100 other sources. Yet however much he's borrowed and stolen, and as we all know that's a lot, Dylan's music has always been full of original thoughts. What's fascinating with great artists is that it's usually tricky to specify where minstrelsy or obvious appropriation stops and something different and fresh begins. Sometimes they coexist outright in, say, Biz Markie or the Beastie Boys. It's far easier to spot lame bizzers like Michael Bolton or the late, not lamented, Robert Palmer than it is to say how an obvious borrower like Dylan or Elvis nonetheless somehow makes the borrowed music his own. While the ingrown persistence and cold corruptions of blackface still structure our feelings, at least we know better now how much pop music just grew out of this gold standard rush of minstrel show writers like Stephen Foster and Dan Emmett, both of whom, by the way, Dylan has covered. Okay, Love and Theft. What interests me about Love and Theft is that it seems bent on demonstrating all of this and a certain understanding of all this. And if I want to pursue a kind of cultural inventory of what's going on in Love and Theft and the sources and the way in which he's kind of using his sources and kind of meditating on the very process of borrowing from sources, I think that same kind of process of self-acknowledging our, you know, borrowed sources of self-creation are useful. I mean, and that's kind of where I want to link this up to the idea of what an education is for, to, you know, to make ourselves aware of where we've come from in terms of the materials that we've woven together in order to create a certain kind of persona or sensibility. So I think it's a model exercise in terms of higher education itself. I don't mean to turn a fabulous record into a dull dissertation, but it does cap, in knowing ways, the artistic process Dylan rediscovered in the 1990s on a record called the 1992 record Good As I've Been to You, the 1993 album World Gone Wrong, and the 1997 record Time Out of Mind, albums full of blues, ballads, and other timeless tunes that constitute, as Dylan put it, a physical plunge into Limitationville. Its borrowings are voluminous and pointed, but unlike the covers on Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong, they are sublated into Dylan's own compositions. And unlike the Party's Over vibe of Time Out of Mind, Time Out of Mind is very kind of doomy and bleak. Love and Theft makes loss and unwholesome gain an occasion for cultural and autobiographical self-consciousness. Quote, I've never recorded an album with more autobiographical songs, Dylan remarked of the record. This is the way I really feel about things. It's not me dragging around a bottle of absinthe and coming up with Baudelairean poems. It's me using everything I know to be true. The album's governing terms, love and theft, become multidimensional metaphors for heartbreak, crime, and time unredeemed, as well as Dylan's career and musical choices. These latter ranging from rockabilly, I guess I'll name the songs, in case you know the record, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, rockabilly, Jump Blues, the song Summer Days, and Soft Shoe Shuffles, By and By, to Country Swing, Floater, Tin Pan Alley, Pop, Moonlight, and Roadhouse Blues, Honest With Me. Those are all songs from Love and Theft. That is, if Love and Theft can be taken as the defining relationship, not only of minstrel show, but probably of all American music, Dylan knows that the terms of his title point in at least two directions.
Love is that cross-cultural attraction among U.S. musical formations, cultural formations generally, responsible for the heady mix Dylan has always tapped. This is the cultural democracy of shared musicking that for Ralph Ellison amounted to an American ideal and that presaged, where it did not as yet parallel, political democracy. Even in the case of blackface minstrel performers, Ellison remarked, these fellows had to go out and listen. They had to open their ears to black speech, even if their purpose was to make it comic, which is true. Theft, on the other hand, points to the exploitative conditions from chattel slavery to the Chitlin Circuit and beyond that have often afforded the sharing of Anglo and African-American musical influences, inflections, forms, phrasings, and titles. We might indeed play on the sense of title as ownership, and note that Dylan doubly undermines his claim to the mixed-up musical territory on Love and Theft, no matter how striking or original it is in Dylan's hands. He wryly implies his thievery in the album's name, Love and Theft, and with scare quotes, calls attention to his thievery of the name. But it's not as though the cultural relations of Love and Theft can be so sweetly separated. This is the United States, after all. This is a quote from one of the songs. I'm going to establish my rule through civil war, Dylan sings in By and By. High waters rise in night and day, especially in New Orleans, would soon after the record be. And if that challenge to survival isn't enough, quote, they got Charles Darwin trapped out there on Highway 5. When I'm there's a Highway 5, in, by the way, in Creationist, Kansas. Barry and Cotton probably know. Not too far from the Kansas City that Big Joe Turner makes it to in High Water. What I'm intimating is that it would be pretty to think that the terms of cross-cultural attraction are free and clear, but the society in which current rockers live is still, if in changed ways, the society structured in dominance, racial dominance, that gave rise to the musical loves of white minstrel men, to say nothing of the black music they loved. Just as there's probably no racially unmixed instance of American culture, so there's no mixed instance, not marked in some way or other by inequalities of power. Love is shot through with theft, and theft with love. Think about High Water, the phrases of which you just heard. Where in the long musical history by which plantation slaves invigorated Anglo-Irish folk tunes, this is plantation music, with a post-African percussive sensibility, only to be commercially represented on the U.S. theatrical stage by white men who gave rise to generations of white rural string music, because that High Water sounds like kind of white fiddle string bands nowadays, because what was originally an African-American sound of banjo plantation music was wholly appropriated by minstrel performers and then white string bands later on. Eventually, to be taken up in homage to black blues man Charlie Patton by somebody self-named Bob Dylan on an album called Love and Theft, where in all that can you even think of escaping the rigors and mortises of racialized cultural life in these United States? I mean, that's a complicated, contradictory, culture-crossing genealogy. Marshall Berman, a cultural critic, very good cultural critic, in an essay called, what else, Love and Theft, puts Dylan in a line of performers that begins with Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer, the first talking picture, 1927. This is Berman. When Jolson paints himself black, he performs multicultural America's first sacrament. He constitutes himself as both the mixer and the mix. This is still Berman. The name Bob Dylan, Berman adds, sounds roughly as real, or real in the same way, as Jack Robin. Jakey Rabinowitz's, in The Jazz Singer, the protagonist, Jakey Rabinowitz's anglicized name in The Jazz Singer. I think this train of thought is both just and misleading. Berman's, that is. Misleading because one ought to be harder on the racial opportunism of Jazz Singer's mix than Berman appears to be. And just, on the other hand, to the extent that such racial opportunism can't help but underlie Bobby Zimmerman's, Bob Dylan's real name, particular brand of blues-based musical innovation. Be a mixer by all means, who can avoid it? But no one can, as Berman has it, constitute the universal mix.
white people too often turn out to be the exemplary mixers. They become white by being exemplary mixers. Like J.K. Rabinowitz puts on the blackface mask, becomes Jack Rabbit, assimilates into white or Broadway mainstream American culture, entertainment culture. Given that you can't elude this dilemma when you're following the Southern Star, as Dylan sings in Mississippi, the surprise is that you sometimes come through the looking glass and find that cultural theft leads to genius, and cultural love is well-nigh impossible. Think of the moment in Masked and Anonymous when the benefit concert promoters, if you've seen the film, it's an odd, crazy film. Think of the moment in Masked and Anonymous when the benefit concert promoters, John Goodman and Jessica Lange, I'll show you a little clip from this in a moment, are imploring Jack Fate, Dylan's character, to agree to perform Jailhouse Rock, the Elvis song. The absurdity of this request, I think we're meant to gather, comes in the fact that Elvis, however much he was a cultural cover artist, the so-called white Negro, was, however, unique, untouchable, not to be covered, even by way of embrace. Can't cover Elvis. So Jack Fate tries to walk out on the benefit concert, but not before these parting lines, and they're articulated by Dylan really hilariously. You ever heard of cellulose? It's in the grass. Cows can digest it, but you can't. Neither can I. Now, what the hell is that supposed to mean? You ever heard of cellulose? It's in the grass. Cows can digest it, but you can't, and neither can I. I think the idea is that Elvis is indigestible, you know? We're still chewing on him. Can't simply take him in and absorb him, cover him in a cover version. By the same token, I'd guess that Dylan regards minstrelsy, whatever its ugliness, as responsible for some of the U.S.'s best music, as well as much of its worst. I've argued elsewhere, for example, that the emancipatory depictions of Jim in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, for example, such as when Jim and Huck are reunited on the raft after their separation in a fog, you probably remember this scene, are no less indebted to the minstrel show. I mean, that is one aspect of the minstrel show that Twain is playing, or Twain loved the minstrel show. They're no less indebted, those good moments are no less indebted to minstrelsy than the more stereotypical moments in a book like Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which is to say there's no transcending or circumventing through sheer will the internally contradictory structures of blackface feeling. They're just there. You can only work through them, you know, plumb them deeply. Stephen Foster's O Susanna, yes, that O Susanna, we all learned it in grade school with whitewashed lyrics. It's originally produced in blackface dialect and with some unsavory depictions of the singer. Stephen Foster's O Susanna, a song of 1848, written in black dialect with some less than palatable suggestions about African-American mental capacity, is nonetheless a great song that exhibits a great deal of sympathetic identification with the black family separated by slavery depicted in it, because that's why he's trying to get back to Alabama. He wants to get back to his loved one in Louisiana. Dylan hasn't covered this song, to my knowledge, but he has recorded Foster's minstrel-inflected but non-dialect Hard Times, which is 1854, another great song that Dylan encyclopedist Michael Gray, for one, has convincingly argued is one of Dylan's greatest vocal performances. Then there's Dixie. Yes, that Dixie. The 1859 Dan Emmett blackface tune, appropriated in short order as the national anthem of the Confederacy, which Dylan performed in Richmond and other cities well before he featured it as a set piece in Masked and Anonymous. I want to show you this because it's fascinating.
Jack, we got so far to go.
Yeah. I'm gonna go put some new strings on this.
See you later.
Later the better.
I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland, Dixieland. I was born early on one frosty morning. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. I wish I was in Dixie, away, away. In Dixieland I'll take my stand, to live and die in Dixie. Away, away. All the way down south in Dixie. Away, away. All the way down south in Dixie. Dixieland, where I was born early on, but frosty morn. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. I wish I was in Dixie, away, away. In Dixieland I'll take my stand, to live and die in Dixie. Away, away.
What the hell is he thinking? The national anthem of the Confederacy. Maybe, as a scholar of old-time music, Dylan has read the competing claims to the song's authorship. A whole book has been devoted to investigating its alleged African-American Ohio author. Source. And maybe he's therefore sought to reopen Dixie to cultural instability. Maybe he knows the possible origins of the word Dixie in 19th century showman's term for the Black South. Maybe, like Michelle Schacht, he wants to step up and face the racial truths of one of the traditions he inherited. But probably not, on all counts. As part of a film taken with the idea of music and myth, the myth of Dylan in particular, I think Masked and Anonymous is a major address to that myth of Dylan's, Dylan himself as a performer. I think it's fair to suggest that in Dylan's eyes, Dixie is a highly resonant song so corrupted by myth-making that it's almost impossible to really hear. Like many of Dylan's own songs, in fact. Hence the defamiliarizing covers of them in several different languages to boot that crowd the film's soundtrack, the most fitting of which, for me, is Shirley Bassey's cover of the always already gospel number, Gotta Serve Somebody, the Dylan song, Gotta Serve Somebody. After all, Dylan and band performed the song after the many references to Jack Fate's mythic has-been status. A lot of fun is made out of that. And just after this performance, the potted journalist Tom Fran, played by Jeff Bridges, demands that Jack Fate disclose the meaning of his and others' mythic dimensions. From the tale of his dead twin brother, Elvis, of course, had a twin brother who died at birth, to Jimi Hendrix's persona, to Jack Fate's absence from Woodstock. Jeff Bridges like is hectoring at what, you know, why weren't you there? What's the deal? As the journalist Jeff Bridges puts it in a later scene, now what pipe of power are you smoking from? Come on, man, tell me. You're supposed to have all the answers. An impossible demand, of course, and it's one of the movie's reasons for being to tell us that it's an impossible demand. To lay waste to the idea that the artist or his art is the sum of other people's myths about them. Just after the first interview with Jack Fate, it's more of a rant by Jeff Bridges, we get a black girl's sweet a cappella rendition of The Times They Are A-Changin', the Dylan song, for a poker-faced Dylan, and the shock of it is that in her mouth we hear the song anew. Masked and Anonymous asks us to hear the songs beyond the meanings that have encrusted them over time. Stepping away from his role as legend or mythic author, a post-iconic Dylan spends most of the movie listening to others. Dylan's performance of Dixie in the film, despite one fumbled moment, which you may have noticed there, gives the tune's proud strut an austere authority that peaks when Dylan, with phlegmy conviction, sings the word die, to live and die in Dixie. He really, really means it, right? He's singing the hell out of it. It's not kitsch, and there's no wink. He's singing for keeps. The black faces in his carnival audience seem uniformly skeptical of this song, which is kind of hilarious. But a mock Abe Lincoln stands among them. You may have seen that. Lincoln does appear to have been a fan of the song Dixie back in the day. And when the song is over, it earns warm applause. There may, in other words, be an affect there worth reclaiming, a roots feeling for a particular locality, Dixie, where present and past are linked through memory. Old times there are not forgotten. Nor is the song's blackface underside ignored in the film at large. Jack Fay is rescued from a flight with the journalist, rescued from a fight with the journalist. Jeff Bridges almost come to blows, and it's kind of funny watching Dylan try to act. It's kind of terrible. This fight is interrupted when another character played by Luke, what's his name? What's the last name? Luke Wilson. Clobbers Jeff Bridges with a guitar, breaks a guitar over his head. The guitar was once owned by Blind Lemon, Jefferson, presumably, but no one ever says. Black music, again, that is, the weapon that saves a white career. Very self-consciously done, I think. And just a little later, blackface muse Oscar Vogel, Ed Harris, materializes. It is there, in that moment, when Dylan talks to Ed Harris in blackface, really odd, it's a very strange moment, that the dynamic of love and theft converges on a corollary theme, that of age, loss, and memory. Ed Harris goes, "Hello, Jack, do you know me?" Vogel puts the question to Dylan. "You look familiar," is Dylan's response, Jack Fate's response. A necessary one, given all the foregoing. You look familiar. And so they're really playing with the idea of blackface and his indebtedness to blackface. Announcing himself the former star of the show, like Jack Fate now, and one of Fate's father's favorite performers, Oscar Vogel, the Ed Harris in blackface character, proceeds to speak rather mysteriously of his responsibility for Fate's father's death. What's striking here is less Vogel's dematerializing and replacement by a black man who stares down at Fate. That's the way the scene works. That, by now, we should know to expect, given the racial themes that the movie's playing with. What's striking is less that than the odd proximity of blackface and paternal death, because he's talking about the death of Jack Fate's father, as though there is some sort of link between them. If we go back to Love and Theft, sort of in closing, just a few more minutes, I think we do, in fact, see a connection between loss, lost love, lost relatives, lost time, and the blues format in which Dylan has chosen to represent that loss. Love and Theft is preoccupied with love, with loss and futility in direct proportion to its refusal to give up, never say die, as Dylan sings on the song Po' Boy. This sets it apart, again, from Time Out of Mind, for example, the earlier record, and gives the record its overall sense of melancholic lift. Song by song, the singer's pathway stones are announced and recuperated by the general buoyancy of his wit and music. "I got love for you and it's all in vain," he sings in one song. "Stayed in Mississippi a day too long," he says in another. "I got my hammer ringing, pretty baby, but the nails ain't going down. I'm not even acquainted with my own desires. I tell myself something's coming." These are all from different songs. "I tell myself something's coming, but it never does. I left all my dreams and hopes buried under tobacco leaves. Don't reach out for me," she said. "Can't you see I'm drowning too? I'm stranded in the city that never sleeps. Riding first-class trains, making the rounds, trying to keep from falling between the cars. I'm on the fringes of the night, fighting back tears that I can't control. Your charms have broken many a heart, and mine is surely one." That's basically all the songs in a row, a line taken from each of them, really every song marked by such sentiments. The oscillation between death drive, that mournful loss, sense of loss, and pleasure principle, the way the songs turn them into pleasure, isn't unique to Love and Theft, of course. It's a structuring principle of all blues. The music's repetitions don't aim to drown in sorrow, but to exorcise it, get rid of it. Allow the repressed to briefly return on its way out of the psyche. The sound of loss and trauma returning in order to be remade comes in the dirty tones, the falling pitches, the flatted E's and B's of the blues scale. And on Love and Theft, in the voice of gravel that intones whole realms of aging and struggle. Dylan does seem singularly intent here, though, on capturing a state Freud termed melancholia. Not the failed mourning of his 1917 essay, Mourning and Melancholia, even less a synonym for depression, but a middling state in which, as Freud summed it up later in The Ego and the Id, the lost love object, someone you loved and lost, is retained in the psyche as a historical component of the self. Once again, a kind of self-making through appropriation or borrowing of a past emotional attachment. In these terms, the content of one's emotional life, this is Freud suggests, and certain contemporary theorists affirm this, the content of one's emotional life is nothing less than the transferential sum of abandoned or lost loves. Everything you ever loved and lost. Everything you ever loved and didn't lose. A nexus of ghostly emotional attachments. The sedimentation of objects loved and lost. The archaeological remainder, as it were, of unresolved grief. Loss inevitably undergirds the self on this view. And if that tends in a variety of ways to haunt us, it also connects us concretely and materially to the past, to history, to past practices. It thus has an immensely productive aspect for thinkers and creative artists, which is why I'd argue, Dylan included, which is why I'd argue that the key line on the whole of Love and Theft is, I wish my mother was still alive. I want to play you that line. I'll play the song until the rest of that line.
Double shuffle, throwing sand on the floor. They're doing the double shuffle, they're throwing sand on the floor. When I left my long time darling, she was standing in the door. He died and left me. My brother got killed in a war. Well, my pa, he died and left me. My brother got killed in the war. My sister, she ran off and got married. Never was heard of anymore. Samantha Brown lived in my house for about 4 or 5 months. Samantha Brown lived in my house for about 4 or 5 months. Don't know how it looked to other people. I never slept with her even once. Had a roof washed out, whether or not it for man or beast. Yeah, the roads washed out, whether or not it for man or beast. Funny the things you had the hardest time parting with are the things you need the least. And I'm 40 miles from the mill, I'm dropping it into overdrive. I'm 40 miles from the mill, I'm dropping it into overdrive.
dial on the radio. I wish my mother was still alive.
Beatty Zimmerman, Dylan's mother, it turns out, died in late January of 2000. To make too much of this fact would be as foolish as thinking it had nothing to do with the feel and spiritual vibe of the album Dylan wrote and recorded a little more than a year later. It is certainly one of the ways Love and Theft is an autobiographical record, to recall Dylan's earlier remark. The line seems to come out of nowhere, as you just heard, at the end of disjointed verses about all these travails. Closer inspection reveals the connections, I think, which have the odd effect of making the song seem even more self-exposing. After the disjointed verses comes, "I'm 40 miles from the mill, I'm dropping it into overdrive," sings it twice. Then, "Setting my dial on the radio, I wish my mother was still alive." In some deep current of feeling, mother and radio are bound up with each other. It's a genius couplet, I think. Both are major modes of cultural, and more specifically musical, transmission. The mother is the pre-linguistic source of all music, after all. Her heartbeat, the first rhythms we hear. Her hum among the first melodies. Losing her in the process of individuation is our first loss. The first lost object to be introjected, as psychoanalysts say, as part of the ego's melancholia, and one template for later relationships. The radio mimics the mother's subsequent status as ghosted, disembodied, musical source, because it's just kind of sound emanating. And its status as a technological anachronism in an age of downloading, music sharing, and iPods casts upon it a similarly vestigial and recursive shadow. That is to say, when you hear the radio, you remember the first time you ever heard the radio, I think. At least I do. The same goes unconsciously for the pull or push of your mother's voice, maybe. So it's no real surprise that the two references might come one after the other, or, as the syntax of the line suggests, that the radio itself might remind the singer of his mama. The phrase "love and theft" finds an especially poignant resonance in the context of Dylan's mother being stolen away. Such is the power of her originary position, moreover, that she might even be the longtime darling the singer last left standing in the door. In any case, Dylan singing about his mother opens rather effortlessly onto singing about music and, by implication, his career and the cultural borrowings that I've been talking about. And given that doing so has helped create a powerful song on a powerful album, we might say that loss is recuperated here by and in the service of a melancholic art. I think I will leave it at that, and thank you very much for coming. And of course, I'd be happy to take questions if you have any.
Great talk, Eric. Thanks.
Thank you, Barry.
A couple of questions. One, I'm really interested in where you ended, you know, this notion of melancholia and loss and the kinds of connections to history that forces us to think about, especially with an artist like Dylan, who's, I think, one of the most self-consciously, historically situated musicians that we have. But that notion that there might be a moment of almost sort of unconscious introjection that enables these kinds of connections to happen makes me think of the passage in Chronicles when he's talking about the album Oh Mercy, and he says, you know, I'd forgotten how to write songs, and then one day, you know, it just happened. They just started coming again, right?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how much of this kind of unconnectedness that you point out in this song is actually key to the kinds of connections to history that we as scholars find in Dylan's work. In other words, how much of what we can find out of there is a kind of accident that comes out of a particular saturation of history that then comes out in these processes, these kind of unconscious melancholic processes.
That's a great set of observations. Because they do seem
almost citational. You know, like, you know, it's kind of this and then this and then this, and it's kind of like, you know, and I guess there's an associative coherence to it, but it's really kind of all over the place, and that citational aspect is kind of interesting to think about. Isn't the moment in Chronicles, Dylan is in the process of writing memoirs, and it's called Chronicles, and Volume 1 has appeared a few years ago. Isn't the rejuvenation precipitated by an incident? Like, he hears some music, but what, I can't remember what it is. He stumbles on, like... Yes, right.
He's got the studio in the back of his house.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he finds this new way to write.
Yeah.
You know, that comes upon him.
Yeah.
It's no. When he's got his hands like all tied up so he can't play guitar.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know? And one of the other things that you notice from this moment that he's songwriting, Dylan is writing words.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, produced under, much of his work is produced kind of on the spot in the studio. It's like you book the studio, which is really expensive. And then you get to the studio and like you haven't written the song yet. And so he's like, oh, hold on a second. And like really, you know, musician after musician tells a story of like it just kind of flows out like, and, you know, four more verses tumble out, you know, and then they record it again. And, the kinds of unconscious, interjected, you know, sources that kind of spur that outpouring are really interesting. That's why it's interesting, too, to watch him in the documentary No Direction Home. I have trouble with certain aspects of that, but it's interesting to hear him actually reflect on, you know, like Greil Marcus makes a big deal about like Dylan. I mean, Dylan did evidently like don't let him near your record collection. He will steal things from you. You know, he did this countless times apparently. They go in people's houses, like 25 records have been gone, you know, and a couple people tell funny stories about having to hunt Bob down and give me my goddamn records back, you know, I know you took them. So Greil Marcus, in his book Invisible Republic, makes a big case for the importance of one compilation to Dylan's sourcing for his stuff, and that is a famous compilation that came out in 1952 called Anthology of American Folk Music. Dylan was asked about this, and Dylan said, "Nah, he makes too much of that. I didn't need the record. I heard the people, right?" And so there's that actual kind of historical, cultural contact with the artists represented on that record, who was still alive in the 50s and early 60s when Dylan was coming up, who are kind of taken in and become kind of like, you know, unconscious kind of voices in his head, you know, and come tumbling out at moments like that. And I think that. In terms of the scholarly question, to kind of reflect on such an inventory is a fascinating, instructive exercise. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry.
Your anecdote about the Stanag records is a quick one for my question.
Yeah.
Because I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more specifically about the ethics of borrowing, theft, what have you. My class in reading that,
yeah.
And sort of at what point is this just called stealing? And to what extent also is it then made okay by simply saying you're right, it's all thievery.
Yeah.
But it's through with love that I stole all this.
Right.
So I'm just wondering if you could talk more concretely about the
It's not an uncomplicated question, it's true. Jonathan Latham, in that piece, The Ecstasy of Influence, makes a big case for a kind of cultural commons. You know, sort of the capitalist or corporate urgency of copyright is kind of a shame when you reflect on, like, how, you know, ideally, how freely culture should circulate, and, like, how, you know, in any kind of healthy culture, this would be a good thing, that people borrow and appropriate and riff on other people's work, because that's what constitutes a community, you know, a community of, like, participants in a kind of collective project. I'm pretty convinced by that, but I do think that you run into trouble, you know, I guess certain facts on the ground. I mean, that ideal community or collective cultural, ongoing cultural collaboration is riven by inequalities of status, so that if you're a very rich Bob Dylan, it behooves, you know, you're in a position to like be interested in that idea much more than if you're sort of a struggling unknown genius who wants, you know, a modicum of credit for an idea. So I can see that would be, you know, the fact remains that Latham's idea of a cultural commons doesn't really fully come to grips with not the ethics for me so much as the politics and the political inequality. Right, of the people engaged in that collective borrowing process. Can you say more about the ethics?
I think I really meant the politics.
Yeah.
But I mean, really, it's about who has the power, who has the money here. I mean, including that it becomes almost wonderful if Bob Dylan owned your 25 albums. Do you know that becomes almost great?
Yes,
you know,
right.
It's my right. collection now. But, and then it's a kind of tribute. But I mean, in reality, so sort of, I was, you know, who in the end is going to actually get paid for their work?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, no, it's an important...
You know, it's, I just think of, you know, say the music is free and it's worth taking, it's great, but then something else has to allow you to live, you know, so...
Yeah. Yeah, in my particular case, there's now apparently a band called Love and Theft. So it's like, in my particular case, I had sort of gotten a certain amount of credit for the book in the first place, but if I hadn't, if it had been absolutely ignored, then I might be a little peeved at this guy, like, generating income and, you know, cultural capital out of something that I, you know, sweated blood over. So, yeah, right, exactly.
And I feel like it was going towards something that I sort of get from this particular album. Uh-huh. So I'm wondering if this is sort of where you were going. Because in addition to being in celebration of culture and art history, I see this being this sort of eulogy.
Huh.
And this being, you know, the death of the mother, the death of mother culture, as he's noted. Which is where I sort of saw you going with the whole
thing. Oh, that's interesting. Nope. And that argument's better than mine. You know, that's a great idea. What's the loss, culturally speaking?
I think part of it is because you do sort of see this sort of a theme of time and how it's, you know, fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is...
Everybody, when this album came out, sort of said, wow, Dylan got old, I think. I think this is one of the things, and I think he probably recognized that too. And I think that... I mean, certainly I recognize with my parents that culture sort of stops belonging to you as much. You start to sort of be feeling more like a bystander.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, I think he's been certainly involved, but I still think there comes a time when you start to sort of see it from the outside and mm-hmm. not so much as from the inside. And mm-hmm. so maybe it's this sort of, again, detachment. But this is a stretch. I don't know. I'm doing this on the spot.
Well, there certainly is. I mean, just the sheer... weight of all those references, there's a kind of, you get the sense that there's a kind of self-conscious, almost curatorial, you know, like, These are the things that really matter. And there's no hierarchy of quality. It's, you know, the Siamese twins are coming to town, like this gruesome sort of racist P.T. Barnum exhibit, Carney thing, all the way to Romeo and Juliet, right? But like that repository, it's like there's an almost kind of cultural literacy aspect to like that, you know, we got to hold on to this stuff. And I'm reminding you that this is our inheritance. This is our cultural inheritance. So I really like that sense, you know, like trying to hold on to that in the face of the withering away of people like his mother, you know, dying, culture dying. And,
the radio dying.
That's a very nice idea. I promise I won't steal it.
It's, if you do, just...
But it's worthy of stealing. Maybe I should steal it, given the theme of the I'll just say who I stole it from. It would be entirely out of luck. But yeah, the thing of being a bystander, you know, the older you get, I mean, did you hear this story the other week where he's on tour, Bob Dylan, and in New Jersey, and before the show, he is walking around a neighborhood in Long Branch, New Jersey, and is stopped by the police because he looks like a suspicious character. And they ask him, you know, what's the deal here? And he says, I'm Bob Dylan. And I don't know if they didn't believe, if they knew who Bob Dylan was, they didn't believe it, or they don't even know who Bob Dylan is. And it sounded to me like they didn't even know who Bob Dylan was, which is kind of like, you know, it's come to this. He must have thought, it's come to this. They don't even know who I am. I can't even just say, I'm Bob Dylan, you know, give me a break. Barry Shank tells me that he appears to have been, I thought it was just cool that he was out, Bob Dylan walking around, you know, investigating the surroundings, you know, at a place where he's playing. He often does these tours where he plays only minor league baseball parks. And this summer he was on tour with Willie Nelson and John Mellencamp. I just thought it was cool that he would go out and just be in the neighborhood and sort of look around and, you know, be culturally curious. Barry tells me that he may well have been trying to find Bruce Springsteen's ancestral home, the home that Springsteen grew up in, because that's apparently the neighborhood where the neighborhood he was found in. The neighborhood in which he was apprehended is the neighborhood Springsteen grew up in, which is like totally cool if that's true. Because he is kind of a cultural scholar, you know, he likes to know these things.
I wonder if you could expand a little bit on the Dixie, because it is so fascinating and so weird.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking here of interpretation of text, because Dylan is taking that, is interpreting it. It's a song from the 1850s, 1859.
Yeah.
And he's sort of yoking it into a new era. And it's a song, I mean, it's so interesting because this is a popular cultural text, always popular culture. It never really ascended into high culture, despite the fact that it became the anthem of the South.
Yeah.
But how do artists interpret popular cultural text to mean differently in different contexts? And if that's what's happening here, what is Dylan doing with it?
Yeah. Well, one answer is very text specific. Text meaning masked and anonymous. If you look at this film, it's curious and odd and interesting film. There's a lot of this. It's implied throughout that the location of the film is under siege. And Barry and I were talking about this earlier. There's a lot of violence on the margins of the story, and it seems like a Los Angeles, but it kind of seems like a kind of third world Los Angeles. And there's almost a way in which, and there are Spanish language versions of a couple of Dylan's songs, and there's the song Señor, which is his song. It's almost like Los Angeles is like the northern outpost of a greater Mexico or something like this, which is at war with itself or with its enemies or something like this. And if that's the case, then Dixie makes a certain kind of anthemic sense of this new territory. You know, it's a bit of an interpretive stretch, but I think it's interesting if something like that is going on. If he, you know, when he does it like in just a show, like I've talked to people who've seen him do it just like in Richmond. That strikes me as like deeply troubling, you know? the capital of the Confederacy, and you're playing Dixie. I don't know what to do with that.
For an idyllic South, but it's a song that's performed by and for Northerners, largely.
True. You know, it may be that he's trying to reclaim that sense. And again, I would just insist that there's a kind of, you know, the way in which he inhabits that song. I love watching him sing it. You know, he's just like really pushing the envelope of the song, both with his throat and with his lungs. You can see his, you can see like the bellows effect of his lungs and the way he's singing. There's even a cool moment where he's looking at the bass player, Tony Garnier, for, it's kind of like a cue, and but to get that certain sound on the word die, to live and die, and Dixie's got to turn his head this way, so he turns his head this way really fast on the second one to be sure that he's in the right position to get that right. It may be that he's trying to get you to listen to it and to take in all of the contextual or contradictory, you know, the fact that it is a Northern song, that it's a more complicated song than we have come to think of it as being. Yeah, Barry?
As you set it up, I mean, you know, part of what Dylan does with minstrelsy is to, like, put it in our face, right?
Yeah.
There is no rock and roll without blackface minstrelsy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's right at the heart of everything.
Yeah.
You know, all of American popular music emerges from that, you know, sort of big bang, right?
Yeah.
And it just puts it right in your face. You can't ignore it. So I think that's really explains a lot of it.
Yep. And I think he's known this for a long time. You know, the standard story about rock and roll is that first there are black forms, and then kind of white performers come in and appropriate those black forms and essentially rip them off. Like, there's the blues and there's gospel, and then there are these groups, but they're segregated, and they don't get the hearing that, like, an Elvis does. Elvis comes along, appropriates this stuff. Elvis starts in motion a whole tradition of essentially sort of mainstream, more often white than black, rock and roll. So rock and roll, when you hear the words rock and roll, you think of white performers now, instead of, say, Muddy Waters, the first, arguably the first rock and roll band in the United States, Muddy Waters band. But I think it's actually, and I think Dylan thinks so too, it's actually more muddy than that. It's more black, it's more compromised, it's more mixed, it's more black, you know, blackface minstrelsy than that. It's not this simple process whereby the authentic gets appropriated and then it becomes inauthentic. It's inauthentic from all the way back. It's about cross-cultural appropriations and, you know, these mixed sources. And that's why I think he wants to throw it in our faces. You know, he's known that for a very long time. Hilariously, he's got the song Minstrel Boy, which is on his a record of 1970 called Self-Portrait. The record is basically all covers. It's all cover songs. So Self-Portrait, you think like the most authentic expressions of myself in Self-Portrait. No, it's all cover songs. So he knows about covers and cultural coverage.
We'll have time for one more question. Is there anyone?
Eric, would you mind elaborating a bit more on the relationship of the creative element in American popular culture to education? I thought you began your talk with a reference to educational sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to hear a little bit more on how you think the two dimensions of our lives, how they compare to one another.
Well, it's a huge, huge question. I think I was trying to suggest a self-conscious awareness of the way in which we create ourselves, and create ourselves by being conscious of what it is we're informed by, you know, where our developing sensibilities come from. And they come from all these different sources. And to be aware of those sources is, you know, and you know, to take on more and more influences to immerse ourselves in ever more increasing acquaintance with cultural texts of all kinds is part of the educational process, but also to be aware of the stuff by which we've been formed. Jean-Paul Sartre has this phrase, I think I'm not misquoting it, from a book called Search for a Method, to make of ourselves of what we have been made. It's like that is the educational process and the self-making process and the kind of refinement is a really coming to understanding and self-consciousness of what we've already been informed by. It's not necessarily taking on more and more, although it's partly that. It's realizing and, it's realizing, becoming ever more, self-conscious of the way we've already been formed by the culture. It goes very deep. And this mention of the mother is important in that sense, too, because the things that we take for granted are, and the things that we do unconsciously without thinking about them, and the cultural assumptions we have, the cultural tics, those things, while seemingly the most natural, are in fact the most learned. I mean, those are the things that go so deep that you don't even remember learning them in the first place. Songs, rhymes, the Pledge of Allegiance, what have you. And it's just the process of bringing that to consciousness, I think, is really crucial and partly what an education is about for me, culturally speaking.
Please join me in thanking Eric Locke. At 6 o'clock, there will be a barbecue and concert on Morgan Field for the Dickinson community. Thank you for coming, and have a nice evening.